We didn't hear his voice come through, but that was the beginning of Alan Toussaint, who passed away last night at the very early age of 77. We lost one of our great musicians in New Orleans, and but later on the program we'll be talking with one who's still with us and one of our great musicians, Ellis Marsalis Jr., will be joining us here on the air a little bit later. Right now we're going to talk about the Urbanite issue that came out. I remember that Tracy Ward, who is a publisher of the Urbanite, told me that we're going to do this wanted to do this special issue on the uprising and was coming together and bringing back some of the people who helped put out the Urbanite over that time. And it's been published. It's out, and we are going to talk about what's in that issue. We have with us in the studio here Dave Dudley, who is co-editor of the Urbanite magazine and co-edited this particular issue. Good to have you. See you, Dave.
Thanks.
Back in the Urbanite shoes.
Indeed.
Lawrence Lanahan, freelance journalist who wrote in this piece. Good to have you here, Lawrence.
Thanks, Mark.
Dr. Elena Hicks is in the studio, retired state employed administrator and college professor and a civil rights activist from a long time ago and still. Good to have you in the studio. Always
welcome.
Always a pleasure to see you. I'm running our studio here with you. And Olu Butterfly joins us by phone, a homeschooling vegetarian entrepreneur, a poet, part of the African Youth Alchemy, and her work can be found at this Fly Woman's Work.com as part of this issue as well. Olu, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Yes, thank you.
410-319-8888 is a number here to call or join us by email, talkatsteinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. But if you can, 410-319-8888 is the number to join us. So, Dave, since you were a part of the conspiracy to start this.
Indeed.
Talk about how this came about.
You know, it was just like the Blues Brothers. You know, we got the band back together. So I was the editor of Urbanite from 2007 till 2010. And Greg Hanscom, who was the editor after me, since moved to Seattle. And Elizabeth Evitz, who was the editor before me. And a lot of us got a call a couple months ago from Tracy Ward, who was the original publisher. And she said, you know, there's some interest in doing something. And what if anything, would you be interested in doing if we could do something? And some of us had been talking. I'd been talking with Lionel Foster, who had been an editor with us, too, and was later a columnist for the City Paper and the Sun. And we'd been, you know, throwing emails around during the period of unrest, you know, sort of talking about what do we do? You know, what is this? What does this mean? And, you know, I had sort of offhandedly said, boy, it would be nice if we had an Urbanite around to you know, give us a platform to weigh in on it. So there was a sort of a lot of pent-up interest in saying something and joining this conversation that in this remarkable moment where the national media had descended upon the city and there were a lot of people, you know, penning think pieces and pondering what all this means, we were eager to join the conversation, and Tracy was able to get some money put together, and a lot of people sort of donated a lot of time, and we were able to put this out.
So in putting this out, I mean, I know, Lawrence, you did a major piece in this paper. I'd like you to, I mean, focusing on Sandtown.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, these guys got in touch with me. I had been reporting in Sandtown for a couple of years, and I think they thought maybe I'd have some way to pull some voices together to make sense of what was happening there. Sandtown's sort of become more of a symbol than an actual place in the last 6 months. This symbol of dysfunction, of quote-unquote rioting. And I just wanted to kind of show the people who live there, the people who are doing the work there, they've been doing it for a long time, and show that if all these people want to fix it and they want to save it. But you can't do that like within the borders of Sandtown. You have to fix the region if you have this kind of hyper-segregation and disinvestment. So I followed a woman I had met. I actually went for Al Jazeera and reported in Sandtown the morning after April 27th. And I met a guy who said, yeah, see that hoop house there, the farm, it caught on fire, that car caught on fire, caught the hoop house on fire, and all these people were coming to fix it. And he's like, you know, we tried to call the fire department to put it out, but they were too busy. So it just sat there and burned, and we tried to find buckets, and we tried to use a hose, and we just couldn't get the thing put out. He said, my buddy Hop was with me, and I said, where's Hop? And he said, you know, gave me his address. So I just knocked on their door, and I met George and Phoebe, who are the couple in this article. And George wasn't there yet. Phoebe said, let me call him. So I hung out with her for a little bit, and I said, where do you, you know. She told me she worked at GBMC. And I said, well, how do you get there? She's like, oh, by bus.
Right.
It's 6 miles away. It takes her an hour and 15 minutes. If you live in Sandtown, you have the longest average commute of the whole city. It's right in the central city. Like, it shouldn't have the longest commute in the city. So so I got out. I went down there, went and caught the bus with her, you know, in the morning. She has to be at GBMC at 6 a.m. So we sat on her stoop at 4:45. And I said, well, are we going to go to the bus stop? And she said, no, I don't want to leave the stoop. She didn't feel safe. But do you know why she didn't feel safe? The police. Because the police see people walking around. They're not from the neighborhood. They see people walking around at 5 in the morning, you know, and she doesn't. They're like, what are you doing out here? She's like, I'm going to work. Same with her husband. They work these crazy overnight shifts. So I just wanted to see what it took to scratch out a living in Sandtown and how epic that can be. And if you read the story, I mean, the commute itself is epic. And then there's all this work going on in the neighborhood that the infrastructure is there for people to lead their own community and rebuild their own community. They're just not connected to the region, and they're not connected to the resources.
And Olu, I'm curious, before we turn to Dr. Helena Hicks in the studio here, just, I mean, what your role in this issue was and what your thoughts are.
Well, my role was to curate the poetry, and I was very excited to work with Urbanite, because I've always seen it as sort of a balanced, optimistic publication, as in, you know, different publications have different personalities, and as opposed to a delusional optimism.
I love that. We're gonna put that on the bumper stickers.
Yes. So I was definitely open to work with the Urbanite, and I thought it was a very important platform, because especially as being sort of a lay student of history, I know that when truth seekers try to go back and find out what really happened in a place, there's 1,000 perspectives, but what ends up becoming the narrative, you know, when we don't record, when we don't put voices, the different voices out there. I just thought it was just really important to participate in this platform. And I might have, as a poet, an inflated sense of the importance of poetry.
Not at all.
I feel like when words fail us, or not when words fail us, when emotions are high and it's not just about a technical story, the poetry can give us an accuracy, an emotional accuracy, a snapshot of time that, you know, a regular journal piece can't give. So.
And I would just say we're looking forward to producing a piece here soon around the Urbanite issue with just the poets. Mm-hmm. To read the poetry and to get into it with you and others, I think that would be a really great way. And one of the things that Helena, you were in this interesting piece in the paper before we take a break here about, I just want to kind of outline all this for our listeners, about the idea of reconciliation. And that was this long piece. You were in it, and Cheryl Knife was in it, and Adam Jackson.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, people somehow have the misconception that you can suddenly right a wrong. You can get people together. You can make everything disappear, and ahead of you is a shining light. You walk toward the light. But they never take time to really think about, how did we get here? Why do we need reconciliation? What was torn apart or taken away that was whole and respectful and human and good that we now have to go this road? And so I thought about that. And, of course, Sandtown, Winchester is one of the oldest black communities in the city. I grew up in that area, and I have roots there. I still have family there. And I started thinking about it and thinking about what the hammer that is constantly pounding down on black men and trying to succeed, what that hammer had done, and how it had really changed the black man's perspective and what he had succumbed to survive. And he has become something that is almost disrespectful. and trying just to survive, to have to become like his oppressors in order to continue to live. I saw it first in the civil rights years when we had all of a sudden, after all the work we'd done, and Mark, of course, is familiar with this, you would see black people standing up when we do protests and say, oh, it's wrong, they shouldn't do this and they shouldn't do that, because they had suddenly forgotten what was wrong, and they were becoming, we used to say they were becoming white, and they took on that posture. And in this situation, that has happened to black men, but the white part that they have taken on is a destructive piece. It has taken away their backbone, their given right and understanding and entitlement, so forth and so on, to really stand up and fight for what they should, what they rightfully deserve, and they have learned that if I give in or if I become like them, I will somehow be able to succeed, raise my family, keep a job, etc. And that is as sick a phenomena that you can have, and the city has produced that, and it's been produced, of course, in other places. But Baltimore, which was a part of the free state of Maryland, the bedrock of civil rights, all the civil rights protests were done peacefully. We may have been taunted and hollered at and so forth, but we didn't have police dogs on us or fire hoses turned on us. And so we were allowed this peaceful protest with the help of other ethnicities. And now we have turned into this animal-like atmosphere when it comes to places like Sandale.
Well, I want to explore that in some more depth, and I think, Olu, I'm going to take a quick break and bring you right back into this. And I think that one of the pieces in this, in the issue that I read, I mean, especially on reconciliation and where we're going, I think this is a huge piece of conversation, and this kind of multi-generational look at this.
Right.
Join us here with your thoughts. 410-319-8888. We're going to come right back as we continue our exploration of this new special edition of the Urbanite out in the streets right now. 410-319-8888. Please join us here. And we're on our way to break. We're going to hear On Your Way Down, the great Alan Toussaint, who left us.
Begin to lose sight. You can't see very clear when you're in flight. It's high time. Last train a running between the water with a powerful line. Last train a running around the hill. Last train a leaving on the quarter.
Alan Toussaint, last train coming. Passed away last night at the age of 77. We're here with Lawrence Lanahan and David Dudley, who co-edited the new Urbanite piece. Lawrence Lanahan wrote a piece in it. Dr. Lena Hicks was part of a conversation inside of that, inside of this new Urbanite about reconciliation, what that means with Adam Jackson, Sherrilyn Ifill, and was, I thought, a very powerfully put together piece. Olu Butterfly, also with us, who is... did the poetry piece, and the poetry inside this piece was just amazing to me. I look forward to getting all these poets together to have added on the air, have the read and slam and more. So join us here, 410-319-8888. Olu, I mean, you've seen the Urbanite issue. I'm curious, you know, when we try to wrestle with this whole question of the uprising that took place in the wake of Freddie Gray's death, there's so much for the city to deal with. I'm curious what part you think this takes in it, and what your response to it was after reading it all.
After reading all the pieces?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to say, first of all, I taught poetry in Sandtown, Winchester, for about all of my adult life.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, the opportunity to curate as opposed to be, you know, my work is not in it, my my poetry itself is not in there, but I had the opportunity to receive, submissions from all over the city and to look at different people's vision of and perception of the city that they live in. That was a good time and very interesting and even eye-opening to myself. So that is, in terms of looking at what is challenging but lovable about the city. I think that was sort of, the theme or what resonated among the pieces is not just, people who are outside looking at the sensationalized chaos, but people who are in it making their life within it on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. So, of course, we can see the challenges, and we can even speak about them with love. So I feel like that's kind of where the pieces were all coming from.
One of the things, because, right after, of course, this happened, WEA was in the middle of all of what was going out there, and our crew and the Steiner Show produced some, I think, pretty amazing video docs in the street from the perspective of the community, which I thought was important. And people always talk about this, and was in the Urban Night as well, about looking at what happened in 1968 and looking at what happened in 2015. It's always interesting to me when people kind of posit this thing that compare these two, because having lived through both, they were very different. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. Extremely different.
Right.
The amount of destruction, the deaths that happened in the result of 1968, the wake of the end of segregation, the beginning of industrialization was a very different period. Mm-hmm. Now we're in the midst of the effects of deindustrialization and what's happened in people's communities in 2015. So they're very different. I'm curious,
sure. When
you wrestle with that, how are you wrestling with that?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the kind of core missions of what we were doing here was to try to use to sort of explore this context, because there was so much great reporting about the unrest while it was happening from you and from City Paper and from The Sun. And we really didn't feel that we had a lot to add to that kind of story. What we thought we could do was try to kind of broaden the scope of the story and look a little bit into the history and look a little bit into the future. So we talked to Fred Harris, who was a senator, who was the last surviving member of the Kerner Commission, which was the federal commission that looked at the 67 riots. It was a really, he's a very kind of rueful conversation about, boy, how things might have been different if people had listened to us a little more carefully back in 68 when we made that report and it kind of got buried.
I'm not sure. Only a few of us maniacs probably even read the report. I mean,
and it's this amazing.
It's time travel. It's the opposite of time travel. You feel like you're reading about today.
Yeah,
exactly.
And exactly. It's this amazingly prescient. The language is very fresh. And this is something that comes through if you talk to people in Baltimore again and again, especially older people, is that, boy, this is not new. We have had this conversation. We had it in the 80s. We had it in the 90s. Why are we keep talking about these fundamental questions of education, transit? How do we get around? Where are the jobs? This is not rocket science. There are ways to make a city function. Why do we have to seem like we have to blow it up and start over again every generation? And that sort of dilemma is really what we were trying to get at, is why is this so hard?
Even the nuances, if you read – I'm sorry, Helena. In your conversation, Adam Jackson and Davon are talking about we need to build Black-led institutions and Black communities. And this is – even that conversation was happening after the 68 riots. If you read Common Ground, Tony Lucas's book about Boston busing, that actually sort of happened at a point where there was a group called, I think, the United Front Black organizers who said, can we please stop having the philanthropic middlemen? Can you mm-hmm. give us the money to do what we're already doing in the community? And they kind of did. The president of CVS, ironically, forked over a whole bunch of money directly to the United Front, going around the mayor, going around the civic fathers and all of that. Just everything I read about back then, I find an analog. I found an analog today.
Yeah.
And the reconciliation... I feel like when people talk about reconciliation, and it's often white people kind of pleading for it, the question is, where does the reconciliation happen? And what's interesting about Sandtown and New Song Community Church and Newborn Holistic Ministries is that they are inviting white people to live there. They have an infrastructure for that to happen. And their way of inviting someone into the community is explicitly racial reconciliation is very explicitly built into it. And the reconciliation is happening in an almost all-black community. It is happening in the place where the damage happened, where the injustice has been perpetrated. So, you know, I never even made that connection until after I wrote this piece of like, oh, man, reconciliation is a huge part of what I wrote about in Sandtown. But it's happening. It's where is it going to happen? Mm-hmm. And who's – and like you wrote about, are we coming to it from an equal place? No, but we can do it in a physical place where at least you are in the community where these things happen rather at some – everybody's talking about come to the table. Well, there's tables there.
Mm-hmm. Helena, you were going to say what?
I'm saying that reconciliation has to be citywide. And you start with what we all think is our greatest vehicle for change, and that's education. We don't get into the schools, and especially not in the privileged schools. Now, I'm not talking about just white public schools. I'm talking about white private schools. Catholic schools, which have always traditionally served both blacks and whites, we don't get in and start beginning to explain to the youngest children and all the way up, give them opportunities, give them examples to understand that we don't need to wait down the road to talk about reconciliation. Mm-hmm. What are the things that keep us from even having to use that word?
We're not near each other. I mean, if you're Dr. Lawrence yes. Brown, who's on here all the time, his fix is the first fix in the magazine, and mm-hmm. it's basically he's like, we need affordable housing in Guilford. You know, he's saying like, we are so hyper segregated that if we can have spaces, you know, change these spaces so they're not so physically divided, you know, then you've got an example of people you need to talk to in the places where to date it has been the most divided.
So how do the four of you think that an issue like this issue from the Urbanite and the issues that are raised in this particular magazine that's coming out, this very special issue, will have an effect on or help the dialogue as we face this election this year? I mean, this election is about, in many ways, the divide in our city. It's about poverty. It's about race. It's about the police. And it's a crowded race. Mm-hmm. Tons of people also running the city council races. It could be a transformative, or it could be the same yawn we've always had. We don't know where we're going to go. But I'm curious what you think the issues are that you raised in this Urbanite have to do with where we're going, have to do with what we're about to face.
Oh, you've already seen it with Graziano, right? You know, every single candidate saying, I'm going to fire him, and I'm going to fire him harder. And that started when the City College students went to City Hall, and they had a very simple – I'm interested to hear what you think of their strategy, Dr. Hicks. They had three very simple demands, and one of them was fire Paul Graziano. And that bubbled up to the point where now you've got Doug Donovan and the Sun interviewing Graziano, and Graziano's on the ropes.
Alou, you want to jump in before we turn to Dr. – okay, Dr. Hicks.
Oh, no. Go ahead.
Alou?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Did you want to jump in on that?
On the protest?
On the conversation about how this – yeah. And how this will affect what this issue is saying to where we're going in this election year.
Well, I know that it seems like this election year is quite fragile and a little bit like a soap opera. So,
that's a good description.
In terms of, you know, every piece and getting at that truth piece, I think is really key. And, you know, the Urbanite trying to span some different issues and different perspectives. So in terms of, you know, people are looking for information to make their next moves. So, in terms of this issue and other information, and, you know, coming to light and really bringing some of these real issues that we need to discuss to the forefront.
Yeah, I mean, one of the – then that's – I mean, that's kind of precisely what I think what we were trying to do with this sense of part of the magazine is devoted to this notion of fix the city. All right, so you're the mayor for a day. What do you do? And we asked a wide range of characters this question. And one of the answers involves using digital technology to increase sort of civic investment and making people, you know, just understand how your government works and pay attention to it. And This is Gus Sentimentes, who has the City Explainer site, where he live streams, you know, meetings and so forth, and really tries to rebuild this sense of sort of civic investment that has been kind of withering, perhaps over the last decade or two, where you're seeing very low voter turnouts and sort of a sense of general kind of torpor and dysfunction. And what we're trying to do is sort of, you know, get people a little more focused on not so much the soap opera, as it were, of politics, but the sort of the fundamentals, like who's got the best ideas and what are some ideas that people should be talking about and people should be demanding their candidates talk about. We don't pick candidates. We didn't get into the sort of the
soap opera. I didn't expect that to. But
we do, or we're trying to sort of create a foundation where people could be able to talk about and insist on candidates talking about some of these ideas, because these are kind of difficult ideas. You know, housing segregation is as fundamental an urban problem as we have in this century. And there's nothing, you know, there's no stroke of a pen that's going to magically transform it. But there are a lot of structural changes you can make with transportation and with certainly with economic questions that need to be sort of seen under this prism.
I mean, it's kind of hard to change. Transportation hit me when you wrote your piece and my transportation with Governor Hogan and his proposals for Baltimore City. We have a long way to go to kind of fix our transportation in this town, Dr. Hicks.
Well, I think we don't face the fact that we need to start with truth, and truth is based on respect. Because if you don't respect your fellow man, then whatever they say doesn't turn out to be truth in your mind. Mm-hmm. So we've got to do the respect thing, and we have to then get to truth. The truth is that it doesn't matter what color you are; we suffer from the same problem.
Exactly.
And so we have to accept that. You can't have reconciliation without those two things, without truth and without respect. We don't have it. And so how do you do it? Well, you've got to talk about it. You've got to talk about it. We've had black politicians a long time. They can't bow out of this. they are heavy reason why things are the way they are. They have not fought for or even raised the issue of the lack of respect. What is lack of respect? When I go down, and I work in Sandtown, West Winchester, I have a vested interest there, Gilmore School number 7, Recreation Center, attached to it. The fact that I can leave my house because I'm the end of the city line, Northwest Baltimore, and there are food trucks up at in front of the courthouse on Wabash Avenue near Reisterstown Road, servicing the federal building employees, the courthouse, anybody who has business up there. The Red Cross is up there, a variety of offices are up there. No food trucks coming to Sandtown, Winchester. Nobody brings food down there. We were looking at how can we just get a food truck coming in once a week, because how do people get fresh fruits and vegetables? Why can't you bring a food truck in here? You know, and they said, well, somebody would have to finance it. Well, the somebody is all the people who are saying somebody should. You're the somebody. You know, why can't we get a food truck in there so that something besides the free lunch program 5 days a week gives children 7 days a week and families the ability to have access to what the rest of us take for granted? Clearly, there hasn't been a food store in that area for years. There's no laundromat. There's no anything that resembles a community. So you don't respect people when you just dump them somewhere. It's like being dumped in the middle of a desert, and you have nothing to take care of your everyday normal needs. That's what they are. You know, what do we do? Why don't we take away the desert? We have the money.
Just we want to spend the money. Olu, so what is your sense of that, of the fix it?
I look at, maybe it's, again, because I'm a poet, that truth part is being huge, even as somebody was mentioning education. I went to some of the most elite schools in the nation, and including Sidwell Friends in D.C. and McDonough here. And I can say that, you know, a good education doesn't always include this piece about truth. So as right. people are voting or trying to understand their neighbors, there's this, you know, complete absence of, like, what really is happening now and what happens. And so when people go to shape policy or to just be in their normal everyday movement, it's just completely void of this you know, recognition of what's really happening. What did a group of people just decide to go live in the slums and they just don't know how to act? Is it, you know, just this reality and this disconnect? So, you know, I look at this urbanite issue and other things like it as an important conversation starter. I know that a lot of people are really not interested in the same old, and they're looking for direct action. You know, the United States as a whole tried to systematically move people away from direct action because that's kind of scary when you just have people who feel unjust and they just go do something about it right then and there, as opposed to funnel them through the channels that you want them to go through. And, you know, as we see with the uprising and some of the other, you know, people going to the city hall and doing protests and things of that nature, people are kind of taking things into their own hands in a different kind of way. But this idea of, like, of truth and real education, I think, is a big deal to this, you know, fix the problem. I mean, there's a million different, like, pieces and steps that we could be doing, you know, whether it's, you know, of course, people eating well. I think that's, like, definitely something that's underrepresented when we talk about justice. But this idea of, like, why is there even a need for justice? Are these people just acting crazy, or what's really happening? It's amazing how uneducated my wonderful neighbors in Baltimore really are about some of these things that are, like, not secrets, but yet they're definitely not taught in schools. They're not discussed in schools. So maybe some schools will take the urbanite issue and use it.
Yeah, we hope so.
Classroom discussions.
That would be great.
You know, and some other things, you know, and of that nature. So, you know, that's kind of, I know that working with young people in Sandtown for so long definitely made everything that happened recently very personal to me, but also, like, I've felt that same urgency for a long time because from working there, it's not like something new happened. It just got publicized in a certain environment. But in terms of just the regular everyday things that people have to deal with, especially children on a daily basis, is criminal. And it is part of a whole historical, if people really get that context and have some education, that, like I said, it's not just like some people decided to go, you know, be poor and live together, you know.
Right. No, and that's one of the things in the issue that really struck me was the fixes part of the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And all the ideas folks had, from enfranchising felons to paying attention to building black business incubators to, I mean, mm-hmm. some real discussions about where we take what we have here. And I think part of it also in your piece on Lawrence on Sandtown, to me, that struck me was the was just why the promise of the 90s didn't work. And those,
right.
to me, fit together.
And it's a lack of – it was partly a lack of respect. I mean, I really like what you said about truth and respect. Respect is not just an interpersonal thing. Disrespect can be a systemic thing. And, Olo, I'd love to hear what you think about this. The kids in these schools, if they're being taught, like, we're trying to teach you out of poverty, and if you don't step it up, we're going to close your school, do the kids feel respected? Do they have – the respect within them from other people that they can bring to the table for reconciliation? I don't know.
Schools are definitely disrespectful places. I'm going to leave it there for a second.
I got to say, so the whole notion of this truth and reconciliation theme, and if you remember the old urbanite, every issue was a theme issue. And one of the very first conversations we had was like, what are we, you know, what's our role in this? And Lionel Foster, who is my co-editor, was the one who sort of said, hey, has anyone heard of Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, which is, you know, these well-known things that were in South Africa and in Central America and South America, to address sort of human rights, widespread official government human rights abuses. And it's a very specific set of you know, it's a structure to create what's called restorative justice. And it's not just kind of something, it's a nice concept, truth and reconciliation. Yeah, we want that. And Lionel's really insisted, no, let's really interrogate this. What does this mean? What would it look like? How you do it? And you know, are we even ready to pursue something like this? Because we're still in the midst of you know, the war is still being fought, and you know, it's not like a South Africa situation where the war is over. You know. And
well, apartheid's over anyway.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you can change the laws, but you haven't really created this even playing field yet, and that's the point we're in now. Is that we have to create that environment where we can even have the discussion about what reconciliation is supposed to look like.
You know, one of the, and I think that we're probably, even I like the issue so much, the focus on it, but the truth and reconciliation, pardon me, is that I think we're terrified of that idea in this country, because truth and reconciliation lead to the other R word that nobody wants.
You mean the synonym for fix, repair?
Repair, reparation, reparations.
It's a little easier to say reconciliation.
You're right, it is, because that's what that would lead to. I mean, once we wrestle with why we're here, we are. I mean, we had an interview you'll hear this Friday that we did with people who were part of the South African student movement who took on the universities in the last month. Mm-hmm. And one of the men and said, you know, I was rereading Bayard Rustin's piece from 1965, which I pulled up before we had to leave here. And I pulled that piece up just to read it again. I had not read it, From Protest to Politics, The Future of the Civil Rights Movement, that the great Bayard Rustin wrote in 65. And in this piece, he's talking about, using the word Negro because that was the word of that moment until it died a few months later, that this was a time when more black folks were on the edge, their jobs were being automated, when more black folks were being unemployed now than during time of segregation. And he went through this whole litany of what was happening in 1965 at that moment. And so you look at that 1965, and here we are 50 years later. Everything Bayard talked about was true, came to fruition, unfortunately, in a greater way. So dealing with truth and reconciliation really means that other R word that we're terrified of. You know, I think that's...
Unless Ta-Nehisi Coates is saying it.
Right. But we all have to say it, I think. So, or try to make us wrestle with it.
Yeah.
This is a great issue. So it's on at the newsstands right now.
It is. It's literally just showing up. So one of the things I want to stress is that this is not a magazine that has like an office with a receptionist and
right.
a fax machine.
Well, this is a special edition. It's out and you all are done. Going back to your other world.
The specialness involves the fact that it was kind of thrown together by a lot of volunteers who are working remotely on nights and weekends, and who we're all very grateful for. So, you know, we're throwing it in the back of cars and driving it around to 2,000-some drop locations around the city, and go to our website, urbanitebaltimore.com, and you can find out where the nearest drop location is, and you hopefully can lay your hands on them.
David Dudley, you just hear him. He's co-editor of this issue, the special issue of the Urbanite magazine on truth and reconciliation. Lawrence Anahan joined us, who wrote the piece on Sandtown. Dr. Lana Hicks, one of our revered elders and dear friend and scholar, was in this issue talking about the truth and reconciliation. And Olu Butterfly joined us, who... of course, curated the incredible poetry section that we'll focus on a little bit later on the program. And also, you can find her work at this flywomanswork.com. Thank the four of you so much.
Thank you so much, Mark.
And thank you all for putting this out. Looking forward to wrestling with this issue some more.
Absolutely.
On shows, taking out pieces of it and putting it out there. Thank you all so much.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. We're going to take a very brief break. And when we come back from this brief break, we have a great deal more to talk about here on the Mark Steiner Show. We're going to be meeting Kathleen Forrester about her new film, which is an amazing film about police brutality and the women whose lives are wrapped around it. And then we'll be talking with Ellis Marsalis Jr. We'll be right back. Welcome back. That's Alan Toussaint Worldwide. We're celebrating him today. the day after he passed away at the age of 77. 410-319-8888 is the number here as we explore this, pardon me, this new issue of The Urbanite. We want you to write to us here at talkatsanashore.org, tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Dave Dudley was one of the two co-editors of Urbanite magazine. The special issue that just came out on Truth and Reconciliation, on the uprising around Freddie Gray, on where we're going as a city. Lawrence Lanahan wrote the piece on Sandtown. He joins us here in studio. Dr. Helena Hicks was in the Urbanite as part of the discussion on Truth and Reconciliation. And Olu Butterfly joins us as well. She curated the poetry in the Urbanite issue. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You know, and so when we left off, we were talking about how Truth and Reconciliation is kind of too scary for people to want to address because of what it would mean to kind of talk about our history and what the reality is and what that might lead to.
And what it would cost.
And what it would cost. Because the piece we were talking about during the break was the piece that Michael Amph wrote about Freddie Gray. And who was Freddie Gray?
Right.
And the question we've been asking on this program a lot, who are the Freddie Grays, male and female, men and women in this world, who are the people that were in your article, Lawrence, the human beings who live every day through this, trying to get to the other side, trying to get through the day. Those are the stories we don't hear.
As Lawrence said, you know, Sandtown became a symbol of everything that can go wrong in a city. And Freddie Gray became a symbol of everything that can go wrong about growing up in places like that. And what Michael Amph, who wrote the piece for us, that's actually cross-posted today on the Atlantic City Lab, if you have a browser handy, what he does in his story is really sort of put all the pieces together, and you see exactly all the structural issues that that he and his family dealt with, from, you know, chronic lead paint poisoning to terrible public schools to complete lack of economic opportunity, and you see how utterly kind of trapped people who are being raised in those situations are, and it's this kind of terrifying indictment of what cities can do to people. And And hopefully, you know, an effort, you know, we talked about, you know, we have these trials coming up. We have a lot of conversation about policing and what will happen next. And we couldn't get into any of that because we're doing a story in a magazine that comes out once. So what we wanted to do is just kind of restore some of the kind of fundamental humanity to this name, to this symbol, and talk about who he was before he became this kind of iconic face that you see all around town. And I think Mike did a great job, and it's a really kind of dark and kind of troubling story, because you see how few choices he was ever really given. And hopefully, you know, what we can learn from this is the next challenge.
I mean, to me, that when I think about where we are right now, I mean, that's part of what I think these next 6 months where these trials are taking place with police officers. Between now and April, when the anniversary of Freddie Gray's death will take place, which also happens to be the anniversary of the 1968 riots that took place,
right,
which oddly enough is also the first is the anniversary of when Mayor Maloof signed the first housing segregation orders in 1910 in the city, which also happens to be the anniversary of the 1861 riots against abolitionists and Union troops that took place in Baltimore in 1861. Yes. April's an interesting month.
You guys should do a segment about
this. We are. Yeah. We are going to do that.
You've done your homework, clearly.
We're working on that. So, I mean, but I think that this all says a lot about where we are and what we have to do about how to marry these things you all have talked about in the Urbanite to really kind of wrestle with what the future is going to be. I mean, and not let this just be a moment where we're just, you know, we have to cover it, but let this not just be a moment where this goes on without us kind of figuring out how the world has failed the Freddie Grays and how we change that.
Right.
How that doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
Which is something you were saying during the break, Helena.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We don't have any consistent citywide method for addressing the issues that were pointed out in the magazine and which we've talked about today and which we know are at the core of creating the Freddie Grays and of non-community communities, because they aren't communities. Mm-hmm. They're spaces where people live. We don't create communities anymore. And speaking about education, when I walked into Sandtown Gilmore School number 7 and there was no library, I said, what do you mean there's no library? How can you have a school with no library? You can go to Africa, which you think is so primitive, and they have libraries. They may not have all the books they need, but they have something called a library. So we got sponsorship for a library. Then I said, well, where are the books? Thanks to this institution, Morgan State University, they helped with getting secondhand books, so many that we had to rent a storage locker. We took down 18 boxes of books to put in that school. I said, the rest go into the recreation center, because parents will need to read. Children will read if they see their parents reading. Mm-hmm. Give us some literature for parents. That is an example of how you begin to dig your way out of this horrible deep hole that we are in with making excuses for why we don't really come forward with the truth, and we don't play in reconciliation, which in my mind is not making everybody happy, but it is saying we now know what's wrong, and this is never going to happen again. Mm-hmm. As far as there being more riots, there will be protests until people have a feeling of peace and satisfaction with their everyday life. If you don't have that, yes, we'll have more riots. If not over Freddie Gray, over something else, the trial or whatever. It will not stop. We have had them over time. Every time we have them, there's a core reason. Something's been ripped apart in terms of people's ability to live a productive life and have be respected as human beings. Until we get that settled, we are going to keep going through the Freddie Grays and the riots.
Olu?
Yes, I think that the future involves pretty simply, not simply, but investment in families. And it's hard to imagine improving upon the structures that are already there as any kind of solution. And but to understand, even to touch on what she just said about if you have parents that read, it's not through standardized testing that there'll be, you know, a change in some of the educational environments that we subject pretty much only poor people to in a certain way. This idea that, and I think it still comes from respect. If you respect people, you understand that they can build an autonomous world that is better for them. We're underutilizing our human capital. So the idea that you have all of these people who can't express themselves fully or solve their own problems because, you know, we have these systems in place and they have to participate in them in certain ways. So the idea of families being the future, the past and the future of how things really work. And a sense of a spiritual revolution. And I don't mean to be, you know, like I said, simplistic, but I just can't imagine, you know, I went to school for engineering because of, you know, wanting to solve some problems in the world in a technical way. But it's just really hard to imagine there being, you know, all these solutions without people having personal momentum. And I think that's what, you know, poetry... That's what I do when I teach poetry, is to help people to gather some parts of themselves towards personal momentum. I mean, after that, you could be a healer, you know, build houses. I mean, anything is possible. But when people are sort of thwarted in their personal momentum as a human being that started off optimistic and confident, that's how you learn to walk. Mm-hmm. And then you sort of degrade into this other thing through these institutions that we've, you know, built. So just in terms of being able to support whole families, not just the children in school, but whole families as units, you know, of
Oh, I'm just bringing this. We have to take a break here because we have to go back to our next segment. People waiting to come in. But this has been, I'm really excited to really get this issue in my hand and to kind of go through it and to bring pieces of this issue back on our program to wrestle with the stuff that's inside of those particular articles and in the Poetry Corner. I think this is an exciting piece. We can spread this out in the next couple of months and get people in here to really kind of see what's in that and kind of. And help us kind of work through this as we face this election and more. You just heard Olu Butterfly, who curated the poetry.
I want to say I co-curated. I want to give a shout-out to Alice Hopper. Sorry.
Okay, cool. That's cool. That's cool. Dave Dudley also co-edited with your
writing. We are all about collaboration.
And Lawrence Anahanna wrote this great piece on Sandtown, and Dr. Helena Hicks, one of our treasurers, who was part of the discussion on truth and reconciliation. Thank the four of you so much, and thanks for getting this Urban Night out.
Thanks, you.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks all the Urbanite people, too. It was great to be a part of it.
Absolutely. Yes. Go out and check it out if you can out there.
Well, people can check it out. We can pick it up all over the city.
And thank you for continuing our battle for civil rights, which we have been into for at least 50 years.
If not longer.
Yes.
We're going to come back with Kathleen Foster to talk about her new film. Stay with us.